WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The Mammy is the first book in a trilogy of novels by Irish writer, comedian, and actor Brendan O'Carroll. It tells the story of Agnes Brown, a struggling young widow with seven children who lives in northern Dublin in the 60s. O'Carroll's own mother was a widow with 10 children in Dublin, but there the resemblance ends. His Mammy, as the Irish call their moms, was a former nun who became the first woman elected to Parliament in Ireland. O'Carroll has some extraordinary stories to tell about her political activism, also about his father's family, many of whom were members of the old IRA. The Mammy has just been adapted for the screen. The film is called Agnes Brown and stars Angelica Houston. It's featured at this year's Cannes Film Festival. I asked Brendan O'Carroll to read from the beginning of his book, The Mammy. Agnes Brown and her best friend Marion are trying to sign up at the local social welfare office.
The social welfare office in Dublin is where everything is handled, from unemployment to widows' pensions to orphans' pensions. And they would not be renowned for their client relationships. So when Agnes Brown, the hero of the book, and her friend Marion arrive at the office, the girl opens the hatch and literally doesn't look at them. She has her head down, pen poised over paper, and her first question would be, "Now, your full name?" "Agnes Loretta Brown," Agnes answered. "Is that Brown with an E?" "Yeah." "And Agnes with an E?" "And Loretta with an E." The girl stared at Agnes, not sure that this woman wasn't taking the piss out of her. "Your maiden name?" "Redden." "Lovely. Now, your husband's name?" "Nicholas Brown. And before you ask, I don't know his maiden name." "Nicholas Brown will be fine." "Occupation?" Agnes looked at Marion and back at the girl and then said softly, "Dead?" "No. When he was alive, what did he do when he was alive?" "Oh, he was a kitchen porter." "And where did he work?" Again, Agnes looked into Marion's blank face. "In the kitchen?" she offered, hoping it was the right answer. "Of course in the kitchen. But which kitchen? Was it a hotel?" "It's still a hotel, isn't it, Marion?" Marion nodded. "Which hotel?" The girl was exasperated now, and the question came out through her teeth. "The Gresham Hotel in O'Connell Street, love," Agnes answered confidently. That was an easy one. The girl scribbled in the answer and moved down the form. "Now, what was the cause of death?" "A hunter," said Agnes. "Was he shot?" the girl asked incredulously. "Was your husband shot?" "By who?" Agnes asked the question as if the girl had found out something about her husband's death that she didn't know herself. "The hunter. Was your husband shot by a hunter?" Agnes was puzzled now. She thought it out for a moment and then took a look of realisation spread over her face. "No, love. A Hillman hunter. He was knocked down by a Hillman hunter. A car." The girl stared at the two women again, then dismissed the thought that this was candid camera. "These are just two gobshites," she told herself. "A motor accident. I see." She scribbled again. The two women could see that she was now writing on the bottom line of the form. They were pleased. But then she turned the form over to a new list of questions. The disappointment of the women was audible. The young girl felt it and, in an effort to ease the tension of the two, said, "That must have been a shock." Agnes thought for a moment. "Yeah, it must have been. Sure, he couldn't have been expecting it."
Brendan O'Carroll, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Barbara.
And that's Brendan O'Carroll reading from his book, The Mammy. Now, was the voice of Agnes Brown the voice of the women all around you growing up in Dublin?
Yeah, I grew up in the city centre of Dublin, and it's populated mainly by dockers, stevedores, and on the female side, market dealers. I had trouble with that when I came to America first, because market dealers are stall dealers that we have in Ireland. We would just call them straight dealers. So when I'm talking to the American publishers over here initially, and they said, "Well, what does the heroine of the book, what does she do for a living?" And I said, "Well, she's a dealer." They went, "Oh my God, no." So I had to explain that it's a market dealer. She sells fresh fruit and vegetables. And I would have hung around on Moore Street, which is our main market area. It's kind of the main fruit, vegetable, fish. You can buy anything from a needle to an anchor, but mainly produce. And I played around there as a kid, and I used to run errands for all of the dealers.
The other very important part of Agnes's life is her friendship with her friend Marion. Now, yeah. Your father died when you were seven. Were you raised by women, by your mom, by aunts? Is that how you developed a sense of how women talk and how they relate to each other?
Yeah, probably because, without a doubt, Barbara, the strongest influences on my life were women. I had six sisters. I was the baby. When my dad died, my mum filled both roles admirably. And as well as that, I also was very lucky that while my older siblings were growing up, my mum was out saving the world. She retired from politics when I was six, and when my dad died, I had the undivided attention of this absolute genius. So between my mum's kind of positive pushing of me and telling me I was the most wonderful thing in the world as a child, and then going from that to the Moore Street Market dealers, and running errands for them and learning from them the value of a penny, because they would think very much in, for instance, if a small bag of potatoes cost 50 pence and they were making 10 pence profit on that, before having a night out, they would actually sit down and think how many bags of potatoes that would cost them. So I learned the value of a penny, the importance of loving your kids, regardless of what you have or what you don't have, from the dealers. And on the other side, my mum giving me a very, very positive attitude. And yet, my mum was full of contradictions, too.
Your mother, apparently not the model for Agnes Brown in the book, although she was also a very strong-minded woman.
Yes.
She entered a convent as a young girl of 20.
Yes.
For
right.
1 year, right?
She actually entered a convent for a few years, doing her apprenticeship, I would say. And then she took her full vows and was a nun for 1 year before she renounced her vows and realised. She started to question her vocation. And of course, in hindsight, having 11 children later, obviously she was right to question her vocation. But it was a bit of a battle for her to get out of, to get rid of the habit, excuse me, to kick the habit. And she took it all the way to Rome and had to fight. I mean, which is back in the 40s, and it was a tough time to be a woman. And she had to fight hard to renounce her vows, and then had to go home and face the sticks and stones, because in Ireland at that time, the only thing worse than not having a priest or a nun in your family was to have had somebody who was in and was now out. So she was a great battler, and she went on a tremendously strong and intelligent woman.
What was her style as an activist?
She was very much a woman's woman, and she was one of those activists who I would say to this in this day and age are very rare, and that she actually followed through on what she believed. I remember I went through my right wing phase as a teenager, and thought, I have a great way of cutting down unemployment. You know, if you give me a machine gun, I'll go down and cut the queue in half. And she said, yeah, well, that'll be fine, except that there are people on unemployment who deserve it. But I said, yeah, but there's so many that don't deserve it, that are working in the black market, and that are, and even those who are getting it, some of the men who are getting it, weren't passing it on to their families, and the benefits weren't going to the kids. And she said, look, if you have 100,000 people on the live register collecting social welfare, and only 10% of those people get it or deserve it, but the only way you can get it to the 10% is to give it to the 90%, well, then that's what you've got to do. And she believed that, and she was right. You've got to do whatever it takes to help marginalised people, even if it means sometimes buying off those who aren't.
Now, your mom was the first woman elected to Parliament in Ireland's history.
Yes.
Did she focus on women's issues in
Very
her
much.
Career?
Yeah, her first, when elected to Parliament, the first thing she wanted to do was to get the word bastard taken off the Irish birth certificate. And the reason she was trying to do this is because when somebody went for a job in Ireland at that time, you had to have your birth certificate. You had to give in your birth certificate. And I won't go into the boring details of why, because it was very much a carryover from the Civil War politics of Ireland that existed at that time. But you had to have your birth certificate. Now, as soon as the word bastard or illegitimate came up in your birth certificate, that was it. You didn't get the job. It was Holy Catholic Ireland, and they just didn't give you the job. So she wanted to get that removed, so, to give everybody an equal chance of getting a job, regardless of what their parentage was. So eventually they got a change to legitimate, and then another concession, they changed it to father unknown. But all of those terms were just different terms for the same thing. This child has no father. And usually meant, you know, this child's mother had a child out of wedlock. Oh my God. So she eventually redesigned the birth certificate. And she designed what we call the short certificate in Ireland. And it's acceptable for everything with the exception of a marriage license or a passport.
My guest is Irish writer and comedian Brendan O'Carroll. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Brendan O'Carroll. When we left off, we were just talking about O'Carroll's mother, who was the first woman elected to the Irish Parliament. Now, your mother wasn't the first person in your family to be politically engaged. Was it your grandfather who was in the IRA?
Yeah, well, let me stress the old IRA. The modern IRA was a guerrilla force. The old IRA were kind of the Republican Army. And although it was he would have been a covert operator. He would have been a commando, for the want of a better word.
He was.
But he eventually they caught up with him.
He was murdered.
Yes, he was. He owned a small candy and cigarette store in Manor Street in Dublin, and although he was quite safe in that his cover hadn't ever been blown, his three eldest sons, which would have been my father's three eldest brothers, were active soldiers. They weren't covert soldiers, and they were well known. And this British contingent came around to the house at 7 in the evening and said, look, we want to know where your three sons are. And they would usually come at night, and what he would do is he'd let them into the store while he was putting on his boots. They'd help themselves to a packet of cigarettes or, you know, a couple of sticks of candy, and then leave. So he was putting on his boots. And they said, you know, we're coming back tonight, and if we don't have the information where your sons are, we'll kill you. So he took it with a grain of salt, and they arrived back at about 10 p.m. And the three sons were upstairs. So when they heard the banging on the door, the sons escaped onto the roof and started to make their way across the rooftops to get out of the area. My dad, who was 9 at the time, he went down with his father, and they didn't even give him a chance to put his boots on. He opened the door and they said, kneel down. And they put a gun to his head and they said, so where are the three boys? And he said, I don't know. And if I knew, I wouldn't tell you. And they said, are you Sinn Féin? And he said, born and I'll die. And they said, then die. And they shot him. They shot him three times, once in the head, once in the chest, and once in the stomach. And then they shot my father, who was only 9, and left him for dead. But an ironic twist to it, there was a curfew on in Ireland at the time. You couldn't be out after dark. None of the populace could be out on the street after dark, unless you had a special pass. And those people who were given special passes were journalists. The bodies were lying in the street because nobody would come out to the street. So the bodies were lying in the street for 2.5 hours. And a journalist arrived on his way back from night shift. And he closed my grandfather's eyes and felt my father. And there was a very weak pulse in my father's arm. So he picked up my father and he ran to the nearest hospital, which luckily wasn't that far away, ran to the nearest infirmary and to get my father in there. But he went home to breakfast that morning and told his family what he'd just done, and his little girl was listening to it, and she was the girl who eventually married my dad, and they became husband and wife. It's a small world.
I know your father died when you were very young, but were these stories that you heard then from his relatives?
Yeah, well, I have the newspaper cuttings of, and again, you know, it illustrates the newspaper press of the time. The story detailed how he had been shot, how he had, they pinned a notice to his shirt when he was lying on the ground that said, this man is a traitor to the Queen, etc., etc. And, you know, it was a punishment shooting. And so I investigated myself, but some of the newspapers at the time, one of them in particular, my grandmother, who was upstairs, was now afraid to come downstairs because she thought they were still in the house. So the line in the newspaper, which I thought was lovely, was, trembling with fear, Mrs. O'Carroll betook herself to prayer. Isn't that lovely? Isn't that charming? You wouldn't see that in the press nowadays.
There are pretty extraordinary circumstances surrounding this journalist, the father of the woman your father married, also, I understand. What was his story?
Well, the story was that my mum's mother made an announcement in her home that she was about to marry a man who actually was older than her own father. So she was 18 at the time, and this guy was 44. And her father wasn't having any of it. He said, absolutely no way was he having any piece of this. So they decided in secret that they would elope. And my grandmother, over a couple of weeks, little by little, snuck her clothes out of the house. And when she had them all ready and all out, she was ready to go away and just go to America. They were going to elope to America, which in that time, I'm talking about early 1900s, eloping to America meant never coming home. There was no 4-hour, 5-hour flights home. So she sat up the night before she was to leave. And she was quite upset. Whatever about her father, who she was at this stage probably really fighting with, the thought of saying goodbye to her mother the next day, with her mother thinking she was just going to work, and never seeing her mother again, was very upsetting to her. And while she was sitting up in the kitchen of the home, her mother came down and said, you know, are you okay? And she said, well, yeah, I'm okay. So they made 2 cups of hot milk, and they sat there sipping hot milk, and in the middle of the conversation, my grandmother eventually told her mother what she was doing, that she was eloping to America. Well, her mother said, look, if your dad knew you were this serious, he would relent, and you could have a proper marriage here in Ireland. So she convinced my grandmother to wake up her father, which he did. And he threw the head. He went bananas. I mean, he went berserk. But then calmed down and agreed that rather than elope, they should get married here in Ireland. My grandmother went around, told her boyfriend, who was delighted. And he went down to Houston Station in Dublin that day to sell the tickets that he'd bought for the elopement. And the tickets were to get the train to Cove in Ireland, or at that time it was called Kingstown. To pick up the Titanic heading for the United States of America. And he sold the tickets to a newly graduated police officer and his wife who just got married. And they went away, they were going away in a break. And he sold them to him. So fast forward, you know, 35 years, and my mum is heading a police commission to try and establish a women's police force in Ireland. And the first in Europe. You know, at that time, the attitude was women can work in the police force, but only, you know, as secretaries and whatever, but not in uniform. And she wanted to establish an Irish women's police force. And she was up against a board of police chiefs, one particular hard nut guy, a real hard nut. He wasn't having any of it. So after one Friday evening, she was walking through Stephen's Green. She bumped into this police chief and he said, you know, it had been a pretty acrimonious day. So the conversation was kind of standoffish. So he said, good night, safe home. She said, I'm not going home. She said, I'm going over to the Shelbourne Hotel where I'm going to have a scotch on the rocks and I'm going to tell the waiter to keep bringing it till I can't pronounce it. So the policeman laughed and he said, well, maybe I'll join you for one or two. So she said, okay. So they started walking together. And on the way, she said, there's a telephone in the hotel. You can ring your wife and tell her, you know, if you want to ring your wife, tell her you'll be late. He said, I'm a widower. I said, I'm sorry to hear that. Is your wife long dead? Well, he said, actually, she drowned on the Titanic. He said, I was lucky to have survived, but she didn't make it. And my mother stopped and said, did you buy the tickets off a gentleman named McHugh? And he said, yes, I did. She said, that was my dad. So they went into the Shelbourne, had copious amounts of scotch, and the next day, history records, the Ban Garda, or the Irish Women's Police Force, was founded.
My guest is Brendan O'Carroll. He's one of Ireland's best-known stand-up comedians. He's also an actor, a playwright, and a best-selling author. He's written a trilogy about the experiences of a young widow with 7 children in northern Dublin. The first book in the series, The Mammy, is just out in paperback here in the U.S. Before you got into show business, you spent about 18 years or so waiting tables. You were a painter. You were a hotel manager, right? Through it all, yes. Were you dreaming of a job in comedy or in the show business?
No, I really wasn't. I was quite contented, and I continue to be quite contented with my lot, and I continue to be amazed at how things are going. Because every day I wake up and I'm sure today is the day they're going to find out that I'm just a waiter and they're all going to want their money back. But hopefully it won't happen for a while yet. No, you might notice a trend there that we've all ended up as waiters or chefs. That's because when my mum did retire from politics, she had £46,000 saved. At that time, you could buy a house in Ireland for £7,000. But instead of buying a house for the family, we moved into a municipal-owned house and rented it. And she bought 2 large houses on the South Circular Road in Dublin and knocked them into one and opened a refuge for battered women, battered wives. And we all worked in the refuge. And that's, you know, we all cooked, we made beds, we served breakfast for the women and kids. And we spent years, all our childhoods, working in this refuge. So with the result that we all ended up in the hotel business, it came very natural to us to have, you know, to be service without civility.
How did you get into comedy?
Completely by accident. I had a partnership in a public house, in a pub in Dublin. And we'd leased this pub and I had this partner. And he was a bit more shifty than I thought he was. So when I came back from holiday, we'd worked in it 3 years. And 3 years, you know, I hadn't taken a day off. So I took a 2-week vacation for my sister's wedding in Toronto. Came back from Toronto and he was gone. And the tables were gone and the chairs were gone and the light fittings were gone and all the beer was gone. And I left the pub and came back to a warehouse. So I was desperate. For the first time in my life, I owed more than I owned. And I went to a friend of mine who had another pub in Dublin. And I said to him, look, I said, I need you to give me a gig. And he said, doing what? I said, comedy. And he laughed straight away. He went, no way. But I had always told jokes at parties. And I knew at a party I could keep an audience, you know, entertained. But that's okay, because I'd be in the humour. But what if you're not in the humour? That's where the pro comes in. And I wasn't sure I could do it then, but there you go. It worked.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Barbara, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for making it so easy.
Brendan O'Carroll's book, The Mammy, is just out in paperback. The film version, called Agnes Brown, is featured at the Cannes Film Festival. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.